Because I have, of course, as usual, if you've been to any of my other talks, way too much stuff to say. So what I'm going to try and do is combine two talks into one. And this talk is about mission-critical SQL CLR. But what it is really a combination of two different talks. The first talk is going to be about how the internals of SQL CLR work. In other words, how you can write things like safe, unsafe code, and why things are safe and why things are unsafe, and what SQL Server does to protect itself. This is usually, I do a two-day class on CLR, and this is usually the part of the class that entails, how do I get my database administrator to allow CLR in SQL Server at all? Right, because they don't want to do it. They want to have everything written in SQL. They don't like languages that they don't understand, that kind of thing. I better watch out. I'll get myself in trouble. And then the second part of the talk is about what is better done in CLR and what is better done in Transact SQL. Because really, CLR isn't the be-all and end-all of everything. You shouldn't use CLR for everything in SQL. In fact, let's start right off the bat. If you do stored procedures that are just data access, SQL runs 2 to 3 times faster than CLR. And that's because of the buffering they do internally. So I'm going to get to that, and I'll talk about some things that are better in CLR, and I'll talk about where the borders are. So that's a little bit about me. Shoot, I didn't put my email address in here. Let me do that. I work for a company called SQL Skills, which you may have heard of. If you've heard of SQL Skills, you've probably heard about the famous people they have there, who are Paul Randall and Kimberly Tripp. I'm not as famous as those people. Those people are DBA-centric people. I'm the developer-centric person in SQL Skills. So I have a website for SQL Skills, my email address. You feel free to send me email anytime you want. Like I said, I'm at Twitter, and there's the blog. I was, I guess, most well-known for writing a couple books about SQL Server 2005, and since that happened, I've never been able to have time to write a book again. However, I did write 125 blog entries on SQL Server 2008. That was almost a book. And also wrote about 30, I think, now on Denali. So there's more coming as soon as Denali has more coming. So that's enough about me. Cool. So let's talk about SQL Server and .NET. So when they designed .NET to run in SQL Server, they really had these three main goals. I've actually presented this a couple times, and people go, that's marketing. No, it's not. This is the three main goals that they had when they started .NET. The first goal was security. One of the things that you can do with .NET is do things like download classes over the internet. And they wanted to make sure that nobody did that and downloaded a class over the internet that would hurt SQL Server, because no database administrator would ever have this again. Also, you can imagine that you could write .NET stored procedures that would go out and look at and change the registry, the file system, and, you know, heaven forbid that happens. So they wanted to make sure that people couldn't do that, at least without their database administrator's consent. It turns out to be very interesting that a lot of the people that have written that stuff are themselves database administrators. So there you go. The next one after security is reliability. So they wanted to make sure when they invented this that they wouldn't be able to do anything that would hurt SQL Server. In other words, they didn't want to use any .NET classes that would leak memory. They didn't want to use any .NET classes that could possibly hold file handles open. Imagine you hold a file handle open and the next person has to use it. That would mean that you'd have to bring down SQL Server, bring it back up. And they also didn't want anything like to have it leak memory even when they had to bring down an app domain. And so they designed it with that in mind. Reliability was goal number two. So security is always goal number one, reliability is goal number two. Goal number three was performance. At one point in the proceedings, apparently, they thought about running SQL Server CLR in a separate process. That's what Oracle does when you run CLR in Oracle. That's what DB2 does when you run CLR in DB2. Interestingly, Oracle has their own Java layer that runs inside the Oracle database, but that's because they wrote their own Java VM. Right, they don't trust anybody but them. And this is Microsoft, so should be able to trust our own people. So the idea with this was, for best performance, they don't run things in a separate process. They actually run things in SQL Server's process, and you can see that they'll load CLR into SQL Server's process. In fact, let's talk about how that works right now. So I can't do anything without doing some kind of a demo here. So let's do a demo with that. So the idea is that's not the right demo. It's not the right tool. There we go. The idea is that when SQL Server needs to load CLR, it will actually load CLR. And if you don't do anything that requires CLR, CLR will never be loaded. And this was fine in 2005, and it worked just great. However, in 2008, they started to write some parts of SQL Server in CLR. The spatial data types are written in CLR. The hierarchy AD data type is written in CLR. And so therefore, there was no way to say, oh, we're going to have, you know, nothing in CLR anymore. Now, when people heard about this, they said, well, this is sort of a parlor trick because there's this switch that says CLR off or CLR on. And how come if I have the switch off, I can still use the spatial data types? And how come if I have the switch off, policy-based management, which is written partially in CLR, still works? And the reason for this is the switch doesn't mean that CLR doesn't load. The switch means that user code that uses CLR doesn't load. And there's a big difference, right? So they will load the CLR for system code. And if I look right here, let me make sure that I have my magnifying glass up so somebody but me can see this. There we go. All right. So what way you look at this is you look at the SQL Server log, and it will tell you when CLR loads. So I've just brought this virtual machine up, which means I've just brought this SQL Server up. And unfortunately, I can't change the font on this, I don't think, so I'm going to have to zoom in. And right here, there we go, it's already loaded CLR. So right after it recovers the database, it loads CLR. And the reason why it loads CLR is because I'm going to use some kind of spatial functions in here. And notice that it says common language runtime functionality initialized using CLR version 2.0.50727. Now, when people see that message, they get all upset, right? Because they say, now, wait a minute. When I installed SQL Server 2008, it installed CLR 3.5 Service Pack 1. Where's 3.5 Service Pack 1? Well, realize that there's two parts of the CLR, right? There's the guts of the CLR that hasn't changed since 2.0, right? Interestingly, they version it in place, right? So 2.0.50727, when 2.0.50727 came out, it was at version 42. Now, if you look at the version of 2.0.50727 that you have out there, it's 3,000 something. So what they actually did was they versioned 2.0 in place. You will never see that change until version 4.0 is supported by SQL Server, and then you will see version 4.0. But you will see a number bigger than 42 as the last number. And notice they sort of obfuscate that from you because they don't show you the last number, right? They're versioning CLR in place. Okay, never mind. So there you go, and they've loaded that. Now, loaded that just means they've initialized that. And notice they've started an app domain up there. So you get app domain messages in SQL Server. And this app domain number 2 is for ms-sql-system-resource.sys.runtime.1. And basically what this app domain is for is that all the CLR stuff in SQL Server, that system CLR stuff, is actually kept in the resource database. The resource database is the hidden database you can't see. And so it doesn't actually load from the resource database, it loads from the GAC. But at this point in time, it's created a specific app domain associated with the resource database so that it can run the system stuff. So that's what happens when my version of 2005 release 2 comes up. Because I'm using spatial stuff, that's what happens. Okay, so in 2005, you won't see that until some of your own code runs. In 2008, you will. So because they run it in process, this is called SQL Server as a Runtime Host. I don't know if a lot of you who have read this book, but there's a book about customizing the .NET runtime written by a guy named Stephen Prechner. It's a Microsoft Press book. And interestingly, when you read this book, it turns out to be all about how you would customize how the .NET runtime loads and works. And you start to read this book and you realize that most of this book is about SQL Server. It turns out that they've customized the runtime quite a lot to make sure that it can run with SQL Server as a runtime host. And SQL Server is pretty much the only runtime host that takes advantage of a lot of the stuff that they do. And this is so that SQL Server can control .NET. Usually they leave .NET control itself. So again, internal uses in 2008. Some of the built-in types are built on CLR. Some system functions use CLR, policy-based management, CDC, MDS. MDS was Master Data Services in 2008 release 2. All of those things have components in CLR. So do realize that if your database administrator says, we don't want any of your CLR stuff messing up our database, know that you have Microsoft CLR stuff. A lot of database administrators are okay with this, right? Because if they do have a problem with this CLR, they can call Microsoft. If they have a problem with a stored procedure that you wrote in C#, they can call you. Well, don't they call you for problems with stored procedures written in TransactSQL? I don't get the connection. But anyway, they're worried. The CLR option for user code, the config option is for user code and does not allow to system code. And so therefore, you can't keep CLR from loading. There's no way you can keep CLR from loading. Okay, so the strategy is to ensure performance that runs in process, to ensure one model. They actually made this up in 2005. There's a layer of SQL Server called SQL OS. And SQL OS is not specific to CLR. It's basically the layer that SQL Server has when they interact with the underlying operating system. When I first saw this, which was apparently an internal moniker at first, I thought that SQL OS meant that SQL Server was an operating system. Not true at all, right? It's the layer that SQL Server uses to interact with the operating system. But they interact with the operating system the same way whether you're running SQL code or whether you're running .NET code. So SQL OS controls all the operations with the operating system. Interactions. To ensure efficient operation, there was an expanding of the hosting APIs. And I'm going to talk about the expansion of the hosting APIs. That's where you want to go. If you want to read that Stephen Pratchner book, it'll tell you exactly how this stuff works. There was also a code review for .NET assemblies. So imagine that you're the owner of WCF, and you're the owner of system.data. One day, somebody from the SQL Server team comes knocking at your door, and they say, we're going to have a code review. And we're going to have a code review to guarantee two things. We're going to guarantee that your code does not leak memory. And we're going to guarantee that your code does not leak memory under two circumstances. The two circumstances that they were really worried about was app domain unload. So when the app domain unloads, they're going to give you a chance to actually free things up. And you better free things up. And the other one was, thread abort. Thread abort was there because imagine you're running your CLR code and it's running along nicely, and then the database administrator issues the kill command against your SPID. Kill command against your SPID will kill your thread. So therefore, you had to architect your code to make sure that it was good for those two circumstances. By the way, SQL Server will unload app domains under conditions of low memory, really low memory. They will just say, okay, that's enough, we'll unload the app domain. So that's why their code had to be consistent. And the different members of .NET, the different libraries in .NET, could opt out or opt into this. So here's a good example. System.data really didn't have a choice. They had to opt into this, right? Because without system.data, we're not going to run any .NET code. So they had to go through and they had to put all these things in. WCF opted out. And so WCF is specifically not supported in SQL CLR. That doesn't mean you can't use it. That means if you have a problem with it, it's your problem, right? If it leaks memory, it's your problem. They don't guarantee that it doesn't leak memory. Everybody else had to guarantee that their code didn't leak memory. And so some of the things, you can actually see this, right? This is the cheap and easy way to see it, and it's not 100% accurate. You bring up Visual Studio, you make one of those cool SQL Server projects, and then you say add a reference, and the list of things you can add are the list of things on the approved list, more or less. I should have brought Visual Studio up before this started. Okay, let me do another slide and get a hold of this. Okay, so that's this code review for FX assemblies. And if your FX assembly is on the list, then it loads. And if not, it's unsafe. It's intrinsically unsafe. Okay, user code, there's three classifications for user code. And that's safe, unsafe, and external access, which you probably know about. But there really is only two reliability buckets. External access is as safe as safe code. The only difference between external access and safe code is that external access is going to go out the SQL Server process. Right? So this is code that goes out to the file system, goes out to the registry, subject to security, of course. But that means that the database administrator can tell the difference about the code that's going to leave the process and the code that's going to stay in process. Right? The database administrator might care that you've written a piece of code that's a trigger that calls a web service, heaven forbid. Right, if you don't have network one day, your trigger that calls a web service could cause a commotion. Right, if you do want to write a trigger that calls a web service, and people do, rather than do that, write a trigger that writes a service broker message. And then in the service broker activation program, there you call your web service. That's okay. Right. Three security buckets. So safe external access and unsafe are security buckets. Did Visual Studio come up yet? Yes, it did. Okay, so we will make a new... And this is just for exposition, so I'm not going to do anything cool with this. New project, eventually. There we go. And we'll make a C# SQL CLR project. I hope I don't upset all the VB people in the room. There we go. It's not going to do anything, so we'll be fine. It will eventually take a while. And when you do this, you're going to have to choose the database if you're using auto-deploy. I've sort of gotten away from auto-deploy in recent times just because there's things that auto-deploy doesn't cover. For example, like multi-value user-defined aggregates. You can't do these with auto-deploy. So rather than figure out what auto-deploy covers and what it doesn't cover, I just give up and use SQL. Okay, so anyway, don't tell them I did that. Add a reference in here. And when you add a reference in here, usually what you see in any kind of .NET code is this big long message box with a whole bunch of choices. And what you see in SQL CLR is a little bitty message box with very few choices. Notice that that's how big the scroll bar is, right? So what can you get? This will give you a list of all the assemblies you have in the database that you were pointing at, and it will also give you a list of all the .NET assemblies on the approved list. For some reason, this was... No, don't do that. Oh, I ruined all my assemblies. Okay, there we go. Oh, I just went to the next tab. For some reason, this is actually listing the 2.0 and the 4.0 version of all these assemblies. Let's get this out of the way right now. SQL Server 2008, 2008 Release 2, 2008 Release 2 with Service Pack 1, or any other version that ends with 8 or 5 is not probably going to support .NET 4 ever. Right. They may support .NET 4. In fact, they're thinking of it for Denali, but they will not support .NET 4 before that. So if you want to use any cool .NET 4 features, figure out a different way to use them. Right. I can make .NET 4 load as soon as I do that. Spatial breaks, policy-based management breaks, and my own code doesn't run. So what's the point? Right. You can make .NET 4 load with configuration file, but it doesn't help because they don't support .NET 4. Okay. So I don't know why the .NET 4 things appear on this list. Maybe they're for Denali. But notice we see very few assemblies on this list. These ones I wrote, System.xml, System.webservices, System.transactions.security. What don't you see on this list? Oh, anything to do with Active Directory, anything to do with messaging, anything to do with WCF. Those folks opted out. And by the way, let's talk about languages at this point, too. So realize that to be on this list, you have to be a Microsoft assembly, an assembly that's in the CLR. So, for example, there is no way for people that write, a different language in .NET, say J++ or J-sharp, to actually be on this list unless they go by all the rules. J-sharp is based on COM. COM doesn't go by all the rules. Therefore, to add two numbers together in J-sharp is an unsafe operation as far as CLR is concerned because they're doing it in COM code. Worse yet, or better yet, if you're a SQL person, SQL Server CLR forbids the use of CodeGen. So anything that does CodeGen, well, that pretty much knocks off all the dynamic languages people like, right? Like Ruby, like somebody was actually wanting to do PowerShell, in SQL Server. So pretty much the languages you're stuck with or that you have available, that was a better way to say it, is C#, Visual Basic.NET, and C++, Managed C++. Realize that anything you use besides that is going to be either unsafe or not work at all. Okay. Active Directory didn't show up on the list either. The idea is that this list can get bigger as time goes on, but this list is hard-coded into SQL Server, and so you're not going to be able to change that list at all. Again, not to say that you can't use these things. If you use these things, you are responsible if something goes wrong. Okay. I've heard people use WCF just fine. There's a guy that has an Active Directory thing that works just great. If it ever leaks memory someday, too bad for him. He has nowhere to turn. Okay. Specifying runtime behavior. So this is how it works internally. Did you realize .NET was always loaded by COM? So the .NET loader is actually a COM component. And in 1.0, 1.1 of .NET, the COM component has an interface on it called iCore Runtime Host. An iCore runtime host is used to load the runtime. It actually has a method called load runtime or something like that. And you, as a runtime host, call this. And by the way, how does it do it if you have a console app? Because you could probably figure ASP.NET as a runtime host is going to be able to call it itself. What if you're a console app? Well, there's a stub built into your console app that actually loads the runtime. Great. Who puts it in? Well, the linker. Okay, so in 1.1, 1.0, this iCore runtime host thing had four or five, I forget which, things that you could pass into it, variables that could you pass into it. And the only thing that you can pass into it is whether you want the server or workstation version of .NET. And by the way, that went away in 2.0. There's no server or workstation version after 1.1 anyway. The version of the CLR you want to load, so you can decide what you want to load. The garbage collection behavior, there was a choice of two, and whether or not just-in-time compiled code was shared between app domains. These were the four things. These were not good enough for SQL Server. SQL Server wanted to control as a runtime host more than those four things. So in .NET 2.0, the .NET guys worked really hard, Prachner was one of them, to create a new interface called ICLR Runtime Host. And ICLR Runtime Host has another method which basically can be used to pass in a vector of pointers. And these pointers are pointers to routines that the CLR should call should it feel like doing something. What do you mean like doing something? Like allocating memory, sure. And so this is ICLR Runtime Host. This vector of pointer thing is called Set Host Control. There's another one called Get Host Manager, which actually contains interface pointers that lets the CLR talk back to SQL Server. Like for what? Oh, like if it, you know, needs something from SQL Server. Get Host Manager allows control of resource allocation, exceptional conditions, code loading, and security particulars from SQL Server itself. So when .NET wants to do something, it asks SQL Server. Okay. So SQL Server controls .NET, again, assembly loading. When it wants to load an assembly in .NET, you call SQL Server and ask to load the assembly. SQL Server will only let you load assemblies that are inside SQL Server. SQL Server will never load assemblies from the GAC unless it's one of its own assemblies, and it will never load assemblies from the internet, obviously. Right? It has to be in SQL Server to be loaded. No assemblies from the file system. Somebody said, what about assembly.load? Well, they intercept that too. And assembly.load just doesn't work. Right? In fact, it's interesting. The only time assembly.load works is inside of a trigger. And that's because inside of a trigger, SQL Server already knows about the assembly you're going to load. It already thinks it's one of its assemblies. So it does work inside of a trigger no other time. Memory allocation. So SQL or CLR in general allocates memory, most of it, on the garbage collected heap. And so if it wants to allocate a garbage collected heap set of memory, what it normally does is just allocate it. What it does in SQL Server is it actually asks SQL Server, is it okay? And SQL Server always usually says it's okay, and what it'll give it back is an address to tell it where to put its garbage collected heap. So therefore, SQL Server can use this to keep track of all the addresses where CLR has ever allocated memory. And it hooks into all the memory allocators. Threading and thread pool management, all SQL Server manages its own threads. So there are no .NET thread pools in there. You can't control them. If you go to create a .NET thread pool, that request goes to SQL Server. Synchronization, that's controlled by SQL Server. I/O completion ports, that's controlled by SQL Server. All these things basically look at the pointer. If the pointer is equal to null, they don't branch there. SQL Server is the only runtime host that fills in all these pointers. Great. .NET garbage collection. Why is this? Well, there's a little flag in SQL Server called short on storage. And if they hit the short on storage flag, things start to happen. And one of the things that start to happen is they start to try and cause a garbage collection in .NET to actually, you know, free up some memory. And so they can actually cause a .NET garbage collection, and you can watch this happen. By the way, I had somebody actually show me how this could happen. If you do read in a lot of huge buffers into memory, this guy was actually using varchar max, and he was reading it into a CLR stored procedure from about 100,000 rows. You could watch him cause, goodness, I forget what they're called, phase 4 or level 4. You could watch it cause hundreds of level 4 garbage collections every, you know, minute or so. So do be careful with how much memory you allocate. You can run SQL Server short. Failure policy. Failure policy is what? Well, what happens when an abnormal condition occurs in a console app in CLR? Well, it just crashes. What happened if SQL Server let that happen? No, just crash. That's not good. Right, so SQL Server intercepts all failures. And SQL Server is going to do more when it intercepts failures than any other runtime host as well. I'll show you some of the things it does. And the failure policy and the handle exception. Okay, so reliability and scalability is enforced in the .NET framework itself, the framework class libraries, and by the way, the framework class libraries always have the same requirement. If you actually use one of those libraries that is not on the list, you have to load it into SQL Server yourself and say it's one of yours. So, and by the way, this can cause problems when you go from one release of .NET to another release of .NET. Because you think it's one of yours, and they replace the one on the GAC, one of the things that SQL Server will do is compare the version you have to the version in the GAC, and if they're not the same, it gets upset. So if you go from one version of .NET to another, I've written a blog entry about this, and if you write unsafe assemblies, then you're going to have to recompile your unsafe assemblies. Fine, right, redeploy your unsafe assemblies. Okay. User code is controlled by the DBA because technically only the DBA has create assembly privilege, and the requirements differ based on permissions. The idea behind this is safe in external access assemblies, it's almost impossible to write unreliable code or code that could bring down SQL Server or code that could leak memory. However, with unsafe, it's possible to do anything you want. And that even includes calling process.exit. Right? They do not prevent you from calling process.exit. And of course, what process gets exited? SQL Server. Sure. Okay. Memory management. So all memory allocation from CLR comes through SQL Server. Most of the garbage collected heap on 32-bit SQL Server is located in some place that used to be called mem-to-leave. Now it's called mem-to-reserve. Bear in mind that mem-to-leave is very small, and it's also shared with OLEDB provider buffers because mem-to-leave is memory outside of SQL Server's memory management. It's not the SQL Server buffers, which means what? Well, it's fairly easy to run out of memory, right? Not easy, but I've seen people like do things like put data sets in stored procedures. Please don't do that. And you can run SQL Server or load huge XML files. You know, it's easy, not easy, but possible to run SQL Server out of memory. And what happens when it does that is it just abends your code and it cleans up the app domain and you go away. Right. So it'll tell you right away. You can also get there over time, because it's possible to fragment this mem-to-leave. It's a finite resource. And therefore, you can have your CLR programs run for days, weeks, or months, and then 3 months later, it can say, oh, I'm out of memory. And in that case, the best thing to do is not to figure out why, it's just to bring down SQL Server and bring it back up, which, of course, will excite your database administrator to no end, right? But that's the idea. In 64-bit systems, they've gotten rid of this mem-to-leave thing. Right, so there is no more mem-to-leave in 64-bit systems, though you think you're safe. But I've actually had people run out of memory in 64-bit systems, too. So it turns out that, max server memory does not cover memory for SQL CLR. So if you do have a problem in 64-bit systems, what you can do is bring down max server memory, like push it down a little bit. That says less memory for SQL Server, but it means more memory for CLR. So if you do have yourself finding out-of-memory problems in 64-bit systems, you can still do something about it. You could monitor SQL CLR's memory, and let's just do that. Right? Because of SQL OS, everything in SQL Server works by a set of things called memory clerks. And so I can do select star from sysdmos memory clerks. 47 minutes. Okay, good. And there's the memory clerks. And you notice that there's a memory clerk for pretty much everything, and here's one for CLR, and here's one for CLR assemblies. Let's talk about why there are two and what they're for. So CLR makes app domains for two reasons. I'm going to preempt one of my own slides. There's two reasons for app domains in SQL Server. One reason for an app domain, SQL Server, to kick off an app domain is to actually run code in, right? And they run code in a specific app domain. And there's one app domain per database, per owner of assemblies. That doesn't mean there's one for every person that uses it. That means there's one for every owner. So if I have 51 assemblies owned by Bob and 3 assemblies owned by DBO, I have 2 app domains, right? So one way to isolate somebody else's code from your code is to actually have a different app domain. Have a different assembly owner, which would have a different app domain. Stop talking that fast. Okay. And why would you do this? Well, one of the things that CLR does not forbid and actually does run in safe mode is reflection. So imagine that you have a payroll application and you have a method on that payroll application. It's located in CLR code called give somebody a raise, right? There's nothing to say that an enterprising programmer that loads into your app domain could actually figure out what's happening by reflection and then call give themselves a raise, right? So if you have a payroll application, you want to have it owned by somebody else so it lives in its own app domain. Somebody said, well, then you could communicate through .NET remoting. Yeah, but .NET remoting isn't on the list, first of all, and they actually, you know, forbid doing that, right? So rather than, you know, worry about it, just put it in its own app domain. Somebody said, well, if I put it in its own app domain, how can I call it? Well, this is one of the interesting things about CLR and SQL Server, and I was going to make a diagram. I'm not really sure if I make a diagram, but I'll get back to that later. How do you call something in somebody else's app domain if you can't call them via the normal inter-app domain ways? Right, but that's one way they use app domains is to run code. The second way they use app domains is when you run create assembly. If you run create assembly or if you run create function or create procedure, anything that uses .NET items, they're going to want to do reflection. Right, and so they're going to want to do reflection. What they do is they spin up another app domain, they load your assembly into that app domain, they do reflection over it. Once they figure out that you followed all the rules and you have all the methods that you say you have, they get rid of that assembly. Let's just do that for fun. Oh, but I didn't do SysDMO as memory clerks first, so hold on. All right, so this one is for running code. This one is for create assembly and creating .NET things. Everybody okay with that? So how to figure out how much memory SQL Server is using for CLR. It would be select star from SysDMOS memory objects, goodness, with a S, please, Bob. There we go, where type equals or like, I'm lazy, CLR, there. And this will give you a list of all the memory objects that are allocated by CLR. And you can look at them, let's look at them a little bit in here. Notice it gives you the memory address. How did they know that? Well, it called the interception method. Pages allocated, these are in SQL Server pages, so they're 8K pages. And what have they loaded so far? Well, they've loaded the CLR hosting. That's actually the thing that kicks off CLR. They've loaded the CLR VM spy. That sounds nefarious. Actually, all that is for the debugger, the in-proc debugger. And notice that takes a whole whopping one page. Okay, they've also loaded the execution engine. And the execution engine takes 81 pages. Fine. They also have an app domain running, but we haven't done any spatial stuff yet, or hierarchy AD stuff, or policy-based management, or CDC. So therefore, that has a whole two pages loaded as well. And a CLR proc, which is just some CLR code that runs around. We got one page worth of that. So if your database administrator is worried about the fact, they used to be, that CLR would take up tons of memory and just take it away from SQL Server and you wouldn't be able to do anything again, just show them this. Right, this is how much memory you're exactly allocating. And when you have that nice stored procedure that returns a data set and then changes it into an XML document, they will show you this too, right? Because they will be upset. Okay. Oh, so then okay, let's just do that. Memory clerks are fine. Perf counters, everything under .NET, and there's actually a .NET perfmon counter for SQL Server, one of them. But you can go by any of the .NET counters in the SQL Server process because they're all just as good. .NET is monitoring itself just as well if it's running in SQL Server, if it's not. Okay, thread management. So one thing about thread management that's interesting in SQL Server is that SQL Server uses a different thread management policy than the operating system. Really? Yeah. I joined Windows, not Microsoft, but joined the Windows family in Windows 3.1. Windows 3.1 had the annoying habit of if you had something that took up the thread, the only thread you had, Windows would appear to hang. And why did they do that? Because they used non-preemptive multitasking. What's non-preemptive multitasking? Your thread gets control, it has to give it back again. If your thread doesn't give control back to the operating system again, you hang. They stopped that in, was it Windows 95 and Windows NT version 3.1. So they haven't done that in a long time. What do they use? Preemptive multitasking. How does that work? You get a time slice and they intercept you at the end, right? They interrupt you and say, okay, give it back. So the interesting thing is that SQL Server itself uses non-preemptive multitasking. They control their own threads and their threads always relinquish control correctly. So now we have a problem, right? Because we have CLR that expects to get interrupted, and we have SQL Server that's going to control its own threads. And so what happens in this case is SQL Server puts some code in to interrupt CLR threads so that they wouldn't be able to just take control and hang SQL Server. That would be a bad thing. And in fact, if you do something like have a nice endless loop, they will actually interrupt you whether you want to or not. And I'm going to demonstrate that in a while. So normally allocates thread pools. Now, what happens if you actually have to go out and you've got an unsafe assembly and you go out to some COM code? Because COM is going to use, preemptive multitasking as well, and they're not going to be able to do the cool thing that they did with CLR. So you're actually going to be able to do a context switch there back to preemptive multitasking in your COM code. So that's fine. Some people say, well, that makes CLR run slower. Other people, Adam Mechanic argued about this last week, said that can make CLR run faster, at which point one of the DBAs said, yeah, at the expense of SQL Server. And yes, that's true, right? It could run faster at the expense of SQL Server. And SQL Server blocking points in the code actually allow transition between these modes. And so let me do the database administrator's biggest nightmare. Right, I have just a ton of CLR demos, and I couldn't figure out which ones to do. So what I did was I queued myself up all of them, and I'm going to run some of them, obviously. Okay, here we go. Goodness, we have here, we have shortcut to the ton of demos. Okay, and this one is about the internals, and this one is called Loop Program. And so, oh goodness, and I haven't apparently converted this to Visual Studio. Fine, open with Visual Studio 2010. And this is necessary because, well, I have Visual Studio 2010, but there are still parts of SQL Server that use 2008. No, I don't want to modify the database connection. Well, it's going to make me anyway. Thank you. And we'll go to the pubs database with this. Great. All right, convert already. There. Fine, I didn't care. All right. So here's a couple of loop functions written in CLR. Now, if you look in the books online, one of the things that books online says is, if you're going to be doing a long-running operation and you're going to hog the processor or processors, what you might want to do every once in a while is a thread sleep zero. Now, what thread sleep zero does is it basically looks around and sees, does anybody else want this thread? And if anybody else wants this thread, they'll give it back. However, this zero is, it looks around for 0 seconds. So basically, if the SQL Server doesn't take that thread right away, it goes back to what it was doing. But if you call thread sleep zero, that's a good idea. It will slow your code down a little bit with the thread sleep zero, but not tremendously, and you'll be a good citizen. This is the guy that's not a good citizen. So all I'm going to do is I'm going to loop forever in this one. So there's a piece of code called forever. There's a piece of code called calculate, because it was actually going to do something once upon a time. And we'll rebuild these guys and deploy them. So deploy started. While this is happening, I want to queue up the one that's written in Transact SQL. Goodness, called reliable. Okay, so here's my Transact SQL loop program. There it is. Do realize that Transact SQL is an interpreter and CLR is a compiler, so this kind of code will always run faster in CLR. I'll talk about that later. So let's run forever 2, first of all. And what I'm going to do is run forever 2, but I have to have something to compete with it. So let's bring this up and do a select star from authors in the pubs database. And what I'm going to do is start my forever 2 out in SQL and then compete with it in one other window. So there we go. And it's going to loop forever. And does it affect the rest of the people on the system? No, it does not. Right? It doesn't touch the rest of the system. It works just fine. Okay. Now let's go back and stop this guy. And let's do the calculate one. Right? And the calculate one was the well-behaved one that called thread sleep zero. And when I do DBO calculate, did this actually deploy? Yeah, good. When I do DBO calculate, it actually acts like the Transact SQL one, believe it or not. There we go. Not bad at all. So as long as you follow the rules, it works great. Now let's see who doesn't follow the rules. Right, because of course, database administrators are sure that programmers do nothing but actually take up great big loops that are going to ruin their SQL Server. Right, that's what programmers exist to do. Right. So we're going to call forever. Now, by the way, this will actually ruin things. And in fact, in earlier versions of SQL Server 2005, watch this. In earlier versions of SQL Server 2005, it could conceivably knock down SQL Server. This is much worse than it looks. The reason why it's much worse than it looks is I only have one person to compete with it. If I had 5 persons to compete with it, it would look better. If I had 10 people, it would look even better still. Right, nobody's going to run this on a system with 2 people and not want to go as fast as they can. Okay, so SQL Server, if you have an misbehaved application like this, and notice this is how long it's taken to this guy to log on. At this point, it'll be calling tech support. Hello? Maybe we'll compete with him some more. Oh, we can't now. Okay. Notice this is a terribly behaved program, right? Somebody said, but that's what you want. It's like, if you want that, go write a console app someplace. Wow, this was bad. Ooh, I'm not very happy at all. Maybe I can crash it. Okay, there we go. So let's just do one more of these to make sure everything's still going the way it should. Okay, good. And now what we're going to do is we're going to look at a dynamic management view called SysDMCLR Tasks and see what it does. Now, SysDMCLR Task is even going to take longer to run because it's actually looking at the internals of the tasks that are running in CLR. So this will take quite a while. By the way, again, if we had more people to compete with it, this would actually run faster. Okay, which seems wrong, but it's right. Okay. Oh, goodness. And see, I have to look at this while the CLR task is running, else I won't see what I want you to see. There we go. Okay. So we have three CLR tasks running. The finalizer, the app domain unloader, and me. And me is the one that's really badly behaved. And notice what they have here. They have a forced yield count. Because what happens is there's a piece of code in SQL Server that keeps track of the fact that you have what SQL Server considers to be a runaway task. And if you have a runaway task, they don't want to kill it. Maybe you want it to do that, right? Maybe it's 4 o'clock in the morning and nobody's doing SQL code and you're doing something important. So therefore, they're not going to kill your code. What they're going to do is they're going to force it to yield. And when they force it to yield, it's actually going to miss 3 or 4 turns on the thread scheduler the next time anybody wants to do anything. So when they force it to yield, it's not going to get control back right away. Everybody okay with this? Let's kill this quickly. There. Okay. So that force yield count goes up and up. All right. So there we go right here. SQL Server detects non-yielding tasks and punishes them, really. Okay. Exception policy. So again, .NET exceptions in SQL Server can't cause anything bad. They can't leak memory, they can't leak handles, they can't leak transactions, and they can't leak anything. By the way, there were special classes put in .NET 2.0, I forgot about this part, if you really want to know, to actually make sure that the stuff in .NET also doesn't fail. Like, what could fail? The jitter. So they actually pre-jit stuff. What about if I'm taking down an app domain? What gets called? Well, they don't like finalizers, because finalizers are guaranteed to be called on a separate thread. So what they did was they make up a class called the safe handle. In .NET 2.0, there is a class called the safe handle, and lots of subclasses that are subclasses of the safe handle. There's one for, say, file handles and so forth. And the idea with it is if they bring down the app domain, even if they bring it crashing down because nobody pays attention, if they bring it crashing down, they will guarantee to call your safe handle and give you one last chance to release all the resources. That's why these guys had to go through a code review. They basically had a handle that everybody used called int pointer, INTPTR, which was a 4-byte handle to memory. And they had to replace all their int pointers by safe handles. So this is not a trivial task, right? So that they could make sure that their safe handles got called. So SQL CLR has an unhandled exception policy, and what it does is something that no other host does. If you have an unhandled exception in .NET code, what they will do is completely unwind the managed stack, and which no other code does. And when they do that, they're looking for allocations and threads. And if locks are detected in your code, they will knock down the app domain. Now, bear in mind that this doesn't happen if you use their libraries, right? If you use safe and external access code, you don't have to worry about this, right? If you use unsafe code, you have to worry about this. So one of the ways to write safe, unsafe code, I've mentioned a couple of them, right? Make sure everything is pre-jitted. Not pre-jitted with the actual, although you could do that too, with the utility that is pre-jitting, but there are actually, attributes you can put in your .NET code to say, this is a critical section, pre-jit this before you do anything, right, before you start to execute anything else. Make sure that you always use safe handles, and don't allow any unhandled exceptions. And if you do, they're going to do this. Okay, if I shut down a session with a kill command, I get a thread abort. If you don't respond to the thread abort correctly, and you can respond to the thread abort correctly, you get what's called a rude thread abort. And a rude thread abort basically says they skip the finally block. And yes, that is the one in try, catch, finally, not the finalizer. Shuts down the app domain again if locks are detected. And what happens if they shut down the app domain? Well, everybody else that's running in that app domain gets a level 16 error that basically says a resource that you need to do your work is now gone. What do you want to do about it? Right? Level 16 error says you can roll back the transaction or not. If you have exact abort, they will roll back on level 16. By the way, that is one nice thing to do then, is to isolate all your unsafe assemblies in one app domain. So if that app domain gets knocked down, it doesn't affect anybody else. Great. Runaway user code, we just saw that. Okay, 30 minutes? Good. Assembly loading. So SQL Server will load an assembly from the database. User code, and remember, they consider anything that's not on that list to be user code. So WCF is considered to be user code. Windows Forms is considered to be user code. Thank goodness. No, I actually had people that wanted to use Windows Forms to use some of the Windows drawing primitives in their SQL code, but don't draw it on a window, for heaven's sake. All right. None of those things are loaded from the file system or from the GAC. And SQL Server decides which framework class libraries can be used. It's a hard-coded list. Uncoded framework class assemblies are considered to be user code and must be loaded into SQL Server. SQL Server validates user code at two separate times. They validate user code at catalog time in a separate app domain, and they also validate it at runtime. So, these are the full list of code that's on the list. Notice they added system.core, that was link, and system.xml.link, that was linked to XML in SQL Server 2008. Somebody says, what about link to SQL or entity framework? And actually asked that question. And first of all, they said that entity framework and link to SQL were doing too much work. They didn't want to go through the code review, one. Second of all, it was a strategic decision to not give people more ways than they needed to do SQL code inside SQL Server. And so I said, but look at this. I now have 9 ways to do XML in SQL Server, and that's okay for XML. Okay, fine. App domains, I already did that one. Anybody got a problem with the app domains? Great. By the way, let's look at app domains then, because we just did something that should load an app domain, right? So let's go back to our thing and go back to the SQL Server log and bring it back up again. And you should notice in here something about app domains. There we go. App domain number 3, which is pubs.dbo.runtime2, was created. That's because I executed something. And then app domain number 4, pubs.dbo.dll, is unloaded. And so I said to myself, well, where's the created message for the DDL app domain? Notice that this is the one that did the create assembly, and this is the one that ran the assembly. Well, it turns out that somebody, in their infinite wisdom, decided that there were too many messages on the log for CLR stuff. And so they did this guy a favor. They nicely got rid of the app domain load message, or app domain created message for DDL app domains. In fact, they got rid of all the messages for DDL app domains in 2005, and this caused the question, what happens between app domain number 2 and app domain number 14? It's like you ran 12 DDL operations. That's what happened. Okay, but they will at least give me the unload this time. Notice they do give you created for runtime app domains. Okay. And notice that you can see how they do the app domains as well. Pubs is the database. DBO is the owner of assemblies. Right, if I had an assembly owned by Bob, I'd see pubs.bob.runtime. Okay, in the same pubs database. Good. 27 minutes. All right. There are also special system app domains. That was the one we saw when SQL Server loaded. The one for the resource database, the one where they run the system code. Okay. User code validation. So at catalog time, SQL Server validates the code. All user code, whether it's safe, unsafe, or external access, has to go through the following validation. All user code has to have a PE header. What's a PE header? So that's the quiz question for the end of the day. What's a PE header? How old are you? Okay, remember that when you loaded Windows originally, Windows loaded after DOS loaded. So you would load DOS, and then you would say start Windows, and Windows would start. So they had to know that Windows was running before they could run certain DLLs. And you might have run one of these programs, tried to run a Windows program under DOS, and it would say, this code requires Microsoft Windows to run. Well, the header that they put in, the executable, to tell them this, was called the portable executable header, or the PE header. So they first of all are going to check for a PE header. When I first saw that, it's like, why? And metadata validation of the IL, why? What could possibly happen? What assembler do you know, or even any kind of product do you know, that puts out invalid PE headers? Well, it turns out there's a deployment thing that can cause this. The way that a few DBAs will actually deploy code from one machine to another is to do this. I have a piece of code, and this piece of code could be .NET code. So go down here under Programmability, under Assemblies, and I will deploy this code, SQL Server Project 2, that I had in here. And the way that I do it is to say script assembly as create to a console window. Fine. I'm sorry, a window in Management Studio. There we go. There we go. Okay. Look what he did. So when he did that, what happened is that they actually have a different version of create assembly that they can use, and you can use it too, that says create assembly from bits. Right, so when they say create assembly from bits, that brings up the following problem. What if you mail that assembly to somebody, and it wraps lines, and somebody puts in a carriage return and line feed? You have just invented your own IL instruction. Or what if you ruin the portable executable header by mistake or on purpose? Ready? Go. It's ruined. All right, let's go to the Northwind database and try and create that assembly. You doubted that they actually look at the portable executable header, did you? Well, there you go. Invalid, unverifiable PE header native stub. So, in fact, they do look at that, and that's why. And they do IL validation through the whole assembly, and that's why. And, of course, they will obviously have to do that, even if it's unsafe code. Everybody okay with that? Now, safe and external access have their own rules, because remember, those are the ones that are guaranteed not to hurt anything. And safe and external access code allow no mutable static variables. What do you mean by mutable static variables? Static variables that aren't defined as read-only. Oh, how come they don't allow mutable static variables? Well, how do you restrict access to a mutable static variable? Critical section, you know, mutex, all those things are synchronization primitives. And I bet you're not going to use SQL Server's synchronization primitives when you do that, right? And so that means when they go down and look for locks, they're going to look at you, right? So they're actually going to look to see that you don't have any mutable static variables. And if you do, they assume that you're using mutexes. And if they assume that, then they're not going to let your code run in safe and external access. In unsafe, you can create your own thread pool if you want to. Go right ahead, right? Your DBA will love that. No dangerous attributes. What do they consider to be dangerous? Well, did I have the list of dangerous attributes? No, I don't. The dangerous attribute example. Okay. There is an attribute for .NET code that's called STA thread, right, attribute. What does that mean? That means if you actually initialize COM on it, it has to run on a thread that's initialized to use COM on a single-threaded department. Everybody remember COM? Well, it has something to do with COM, okay. So STA thread is considered a dangerous attribute. How come? It means that SQL Server actually has to look at the thread it schedules to run .NET code on to see if it's been initialized the right way. And SQL Server doesn't like people telling it what to do. And so therefore, if you use an STA thread attribute on your .NET code, they make you make it unsafe. Everybody okay with that? It's considered to be dangerous because it tells SQL Server what to do. No finalizers. Why no finalizers? They didn't think these were safe either because these are called on a separate thread, and apparently programmers don't know how to use finalizers. Well, maybe. Okay, and type safe, right? No void pointers to star, no unsafe attribute in C-sharp code, right? You can write unsafe C-sharp code with the right attributes. Let's just do one of those real quick, like, okay. So, let's not have a loop program. Let's have a SQL Server project one. Okay, this is pretty easy, right? Add. New item, class, there's a class, call class one, there we go. And I'm actually going to change this because I'm going to use manual deployment so you can see the error message better. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to put it in temp because I don't want to have to type in the name of the entire place where this lives. So ctemp is where it's going to be deployed to. There we go. And it's actually going to be called SQL Server Project 1, fine. And what do we have to do? Now put an immutable static variable. Static. Int x. And we'll initialize it too. There. Okay, so now let's build that. And let's try and catalog that. Okay, the build worked. Let's go into database of our choice and try and catalog that as create assembly foo from, and we're going to use ctemp SQL Server 1.dll. There we go. Okay. So when we do that, it says, oh, because I can't spell, SQL Server Project 1. SQL Server Project 1. Failed because I don't know how to spell SQL Server Project 1. There. And that create assembly failed because the class in safe assembly has a static field X. Sure. And static fields are only allowed if they're, you know, because somebody complained about the fact that SQL Server didn't have descriptive error messages once upon a time. And so they're going to give you the whole big story, right? You don't have to have a class. Just run it and get the wrong error message, right? Okay. So anyway, they will check your stuff. Now, if I really wanted to, I could escalate to unsafe at this point, but I don't really care to do that for the static variable. Code review talked about these things. Constrained execution region, execute code with guaranteed cleanup, and safe handle, perfect. Right. Also, imagine that you have assembly that they have to have in there, but they're going to do a code review on the assembly, and that's fine. But the assembly has some things that are safe, some things that are unsafe. Right. What's an assembly like that? mscorelib.dll. What's an mscorelib? Oh, the threading, for one. Right. Your own threading. What's an mscorelib that we need? Oh, almost everything. right? So therefore, they had to have a way to have a safe assembly with some unsafe things in it. And so the way that they did this was, not only did they have to use all these new classes, but they had to mark all their assemblies with these things called host protection attributes. So there was a new class introduced in 2.0 in system security that was called host protection attribute. And basically, these guys had to go through all their code and mark it with a host protection attribute. So let me show you one of these. So where's MS Corelib? Oh, there it is. Okay, so this is Reflector. If we get on here with Reflector to Common Net Runtime Library, how do you start a thread? Somebody quick while I'm getting to it. Thread.start, sure. So system.threading.thread.start. Okay, remember, I'm not allowed to start my own thread except in unsafe mode. So there's system.threading.thread.start. Let's look at the code for it. There we go. And notice that they put in some additional attributes, but there's my host protection attribute right there. And notice it is a security attribute link demand. It's also called a disappearing attribute. Because what happens is, when the system hits a host protection attribute, and it doesn't hit this exactly at runtime, it hits this at just-in-time compile time. Right? The first time your code is just-in-time compiled. And when it hits this attribute, it says, oh wait, that means I have to call SQL Server. Do they have anything in this vector of pointers? Oh yeah, it's not null. We'll have to call that. And basically, the host protection attribute comes with a, list of things that SQL Server can object to. And by the way, this was meant so that it could be used by other runtime hosts, but SQL Server objects to everything you might put in this. So synchronization is true, external threading equals true, it'll call SQL Server. And if you're in unsafe mode, SQL Server will go, yeah, that's all right. And if you're in safer external access, they'll say, nope, don't bother, right? And so you will actually get a runtime system.security exception if this happens. Why? Because they're not going to go through every single method in every assembly and everything it could possibly call as many levels deep down when you actually run create assembly. This happens at execution time. If you want to make it happen at execution time, I'm not going to do it now. Do something that requires external access and catalog the assembly as safe. You will notice the SQL Server does not care. And then try and do that thing that has external access, like write to the file system. And at that point, you'll get a system.security exception. Everybody okay with that? There are a lot of different reasons why host protection attributes can have these things. My favorite is there's one called may leak on abort equals true. It's like, who writes code that may leak on abort equals true? Well, apparently the time zone class in .NET may leak on abort equals true. Because somebody found that in there. It's like, okay. I won't even ask how that got there. Right? Here's all the things that SQL Server can object to. And yes, there is a may leak on abort. But anyway, SQL Server will object to every one. The reason why they made it this granular was they figured some other runtime host like ASP.NET might want to use it someday. They don't. Okay. Permission sets. So .NET assemblies use permission sets, but these permission sets aren't going to use the location-based CAS permissions. The permission sets that SQL Server has, safe, unsafe, and external access, are actually defined with CAS permissions. Right, that's code access security permissions. You can't see them in the list of code access security permissions. And the reason I know this is because I was doing a talk like this once, and somebody came up after the talk and they said, I would like to have my own permission set. And I said, you can't. There are only three. And the person said, well, if I can't have my own permission set, then I'm not going to use it. And I said, talk to the SQL Server guys. I'm sorry. Right? I know for a fact you can't have your own permission set in SQL Server. And so I said, why do you care? And he goes, well, I work for a government agency. I think it was the NSA, one of these spy government agencies, right? And he said, I want to have the NSA permission set. So I talked to SQL Server. Maybe they'll make a special permission set just for you. And then I found out that, he said, are you sure? And I said, yeah, if I ever find out differently, I'll call you, you know, give me your card. And of course he didn't. But I found out about a week later that I was wrong. It turns out that you can't have a permission set of your very own that you define yourself, but SQL Server will go by the CAS permission sets that you have set up at other levels. So if you have a permission set up for the machine, or if you have a permission set level you have set up for the domain, SQL Server will go by that. So you can't make your own permission set, but you can use one of its permission sets and take permissions away. So suppose they didn't want to allow, reflection. They could make their own permission set that was safe but didn't allow reflection. Cool. You can take them away. And somebody did that at one of the classes that I wrote, or taught. Okay. I'm going to switch gears at this point. And I'm going to talk about using CLR code. I have 15 minutes, and I'm also going to talk about when to use it. So here's the big misconception that some people have about SQL CLR. I got my SQL Server. Did I even make a diagram? No, I didn't. Okay, but this is a big deal. I got my SQL Server running over here, and over here I've got .NET code, right? SQL Server, .NET code. And I can load that .NET code into SQL Server's memory. Over here, I have a SQL Server client. I'm sorry, I have a SQL Server client that wants to call that .NET code. It's a .NET client. So people think I should be able to call from my .NET client directly into the .NET code in SQL Server. That doesn't happen, right? If you think that happens, you might be in the wrong place, right? Because that will never happen, right? How does a client call .NET code in SQL Server? The only way that a client can call .NET code in SQL Server is through these entry points into .NET code. And what are the entry points called? Stored procedure, user defined function, trigger, user defined type, user defined attribute. You can call those. That's why you have to run create function and tell it where your function is. That's why you have to run create user defined type. So somebody says, can I call into .NET and pass in a hash table? And I said, oh, you mean a temporary table? And they said, no, a hash table, right? System.collections.hashTable. And I said, depends. And he said, what do you mean depends? And no, you cannot call from a .NET client and pass a hash table to a .NET stored procedure. How come? Well, it has to go through this SQL layer, and SQL doesn't support stored procedure, hash table, at least not System.collections.hashTable. Okay. And they say, well, when can I call it then? Well, imagine that you pass in, you have a function that you can actually pass in numbers to, and you can call that function lots of times. Once that function has enough numbers, you can say, I'm done now. It can make up a hash table in its own CLR code because you've come in through the front door correctly. In other words, once you're through that front door, all the rules of CLR apply. Until you get through that front door, none of the rules of CLR apply. Only the rules that are shared between CLR and Transact SQL apply. Here's another rule on the other side. How do you pass a varchar to a .NET stored procedure? And the answer is you don't. And the reason is because .NET doesn't have a non-Unicode string data type. Right? They have a Unicode string data type. Somebody always wants to tell me about the types in the UTF-8 types in system.txt. Yeah, they don't use those. Right, so therefore, the only thing that you can do to get in through the front door is to do the things that are supported by both Transact SQL and .NET. Everybody okay with that? Great. At one point, they had thought of that, right? Allowing people to call .NET code directly from clients. And then somebody said, nah. Okay, so all codes go through Transact SQL entry points. These are considered to be Transact SQL objects, and can have the same type of stuff that other Transact SQL objects have. Like what? Well, I was talking yesterday in the security part of the class, or the security thing that I was doing, about being able to code sign a stored procedure. Can you code sign a .NET stored procedure? Sure, right, it's a .NET stored procedure. I have actually never tried that. I should have tried that this morning. But there shouldn't be any reason. It's a stored procedure, right? So, calling between stacks. So, subroutine calls inside SQL Server can be from Transact SQL to Transact SQL, obviously. A Transact SQL stored procedure can call another Transact SQL stored procedure, fine. They can also be from Transact SQL to CLR. A Transact SQL stored procedure can call a .NET stored procedure, sure. And they can be from CLR to Transact SQL. You can run a CLR stored procedure, how do you get data back? ADO.NET. What does it do? It calls Transact SQL, sure. So CLR to Transact SQL. And CLR to CLR. How do you do that? Well, once you've got inside a CLR user-defined type, you can do anything you want inside of that type. In fact, I can give you this one because I'm running out of time here. At one point, I made a user-defined type or a library of user-defined types called the Zoo. And the Zoo had two classes in it. One was cat, and the other one was tiger. And obviously, tiger is a cat, if you believe object-oriented. SQL Server doesn't know about object-oriented. So if I knew up a tiger in my .NET code, and then I call a method called feed the cat on the tiger class, the tiger doesn't have feed the cat, but the cat does. And so the cat will say meow. Really, it did. Didn't do sound, but you know. And what happens is, though, if you knew up declare @t as tiger and call the feed the cat method on Tiger, the SQL server will say, Transact SQL, I don't know anything about that method. Right? Now, you can have forwarding methods, but CLR doesn't care how you implement your types as long as they go by the rules of CLR. SQL doesn't know anything about inheritance. Okay, fine. No inheritance, no polymorphism. Somebody said, well, if I have two polymorphic functions, I can at least declare one of them. No, if you have two polymorphic functions, you can't declare either of them. How come? Because SQL is going to have to decide this at runtime, and it's not going to do it. It just won't let you declare a polymorphic function. That's what the reflection is about. Okay, so is everybody okay with this? One of the interesting things that I love to show people, but I don't have time, is the difference between system.decimal and SQL Server's decimal. So I'll just describe it. System.decimal is based on an IEEE 756 standard. You can tell I looked this up. And basically what it's called is a floating point type decimal. And that means that the decimal can have a precision and scale that it decides on at runtime. Right? Think about it. In .NET, well, it's easy to see. Right? Now, the SQL Server decimal data type is... I had to do this, right? Had to do it. All right. The SQL Server decimal data type is a fixed precision data type. And so you have to specify the precision and scale. So, well, it's 2008. What's the answer? X plus Y. Come on, it's the end of the day. 3. Nope, it's actually 3. I heard 3 and I was happy, then I heard more numbers after that and it's only 3. How come it's only 3? Well, first of all, is it only 3? Yeah, it's only 3. How come? Well, decimal is a fixed precision and scale, so tell me. This was the audience participation part anyway. What is the default precision and scale of a decimal data type? 18, 0, and how did you know that? Because you did decimal data type development with SQL CLR. You find that out real quick. So I have defined this. So what happens is what? In this assignment, it's going to make it to a zero precision. In this assignment, it's going to make a zero precision. That's fine. Notice that it should have rounded off. If I actually made this, what was I going to do with this? Goodness, 2.6, right? Because 1.2 and 2.3 is 2.5, so it should have rounded up if it was rounding. But it rounds on assignment, not on the addition. And so forth, that's going to get me what? 4. Be careful with this. Right, the other difference between the two is that .NET's decimal data type only goes up to 10 to the 28th power, or down to 10 to the minus 28th in some change. Right, SQL Server's decimal data type goes up to 10 to the 38th power. Why does this matter? Not often, but divide 1 by 3. Okay. Now, the .NET data provider actually has a way to fix divide 1 by 3, but be careful with this. All right. Also, SQL types are not nullable, so you have to use special nullable types. Originally, they didn't trust that the .NET people would be finished with their .NET nullable types in time, so therefore what they did is they had their own nullable types called system.data.sqlTypes, and they used those. In 2008, you can use nullable types, .NET's nullable types. You can't in 2005. By the way, this complicated everything tremendously. How come? Well, they decided .NET nullable types were the future, and so for date time offset, they don't have a SQL type, they just have a nullable type. Okay. What about for, the other one is that .NET nullable types can't be called over a reference type in .NET, only a value type. What's a reference type in .NET that I might want to use? System.string. And so I can't use a nullable string data type. Oh, well, that's lousy because that means half the time I have to use nullable types and half the time I have to use system.data.sql types. Lots of fun. Right, it's not half and half, but it's something like that. 6 minutes, I wanted to show you the really cool demo. So here's the data type mappings, fine. Another data type mappings, fine. Okay, so when do you use what? So first of all, if you have a SQL statement, use SQL. Don't use .NET to reinvent the cursor. Right? There's a reason why they invented SQL, and that was because there's a query optimizer, and the query optimizer will optimize your SQL code. Don't just reinvent cursors because you have them in .NET. By the way, there's an exception to this rule. If you're actually going to be doing a lot of computation inside of your cursor, it might be better actually to do a .NET cursor, right? Because .NET is going to do this computation. When if I use this in spatial data? If I do a lot of spatial computations, it might be better to do that in something that looks like a cursor. Don't be too upset. It's not a SQL cursor, it's a .NET cursor. .NET uses iterators. Remember, if you have SQL at the end of the day, SQL uses iterators too. So it's not like, but it's a, you know, very minute chance that you might want to use these. Cursor is slower in any languages, right? And it defeats the optimizer. I always tell people that cursor is like tying the optimizer's hands behind its back and saying, never mind, I'll do this. So which procedural language then? Well, Transact SQL is interpreted, CLR is compiled. Is that a big idea, a big deal? Yeah, it is if you do a lot of computation, right? And in fact, if you have a user-defined scalar functions, first of all, let's get this out of the way. User-defined scalar functions in Transact SQL should not do, I'm sorry, user-defined scalar functions at all should not do data access. How come? Well, that's another story, right? But everybody's nodding their head. They know this already, right? User-defined functions in any language should not do data access. Leave it at that. Okay. Now, that leaves user-defined functions that do not do data access. What do? Computation. They're always better in .NET. Always? Always. Well, wait a minute. I read, so there's a white paper about SQL CLR. There is only one. And the white paper said there is a three-integer overhead in calling from a SQL item into a .NET item. And so once upon a time, I'll give you this code, I set out to prove this overhead. And I figured, oh, I could knock it down to two-integer instructions, and SQL to SQL would run faster than SQL to .NET. Right? And it turned out that didn't happen, and I was kind of upset. And I knocked it down to one instruction, and it still didn't happen. And I knocked it down to just return zero, and the CLR code was still faster. And I called the guy, well, I didn't call him, I don't know his phone number, but I wrote the guy that actually wrote the white paper, and I said, Balaji, what's the deal here? It runs faster in CLR all the time. And he said, no, it doesn't. There's a three-integer instruction overhead. And it's like, yeah, that's fine. So then a guy named Gert Draper's got a hold of this code. You may have heard of Gert. He's from around here. And Gert said, what's this code that's doing to return zero? And I said, oh, that's just to prove the overhead. And he said, well, why don't you use it? And I said, it doesn't prove the overhead. So he actually came back to them, and he came back to me, and he said, Balaji says you're right. They did some optimization at the end of the release cycle in 2005. Calling .NET code inside of a scalar function always is faster than calling SQL code. Okay, so there. They actually published this in a blog entry that nobody ever read just a little while after this. But I was vindicated, and I was happy, and at least I didn't do anything tremendously wrong. Now, that's not the same thing if you call a stored procedure, because if you call a stored procedure that doesn't do data access, it turns out that they will assume that stored procedures always do data access. And so they will set up this thing called the SQL context. The SQL context is your environment inside of SQL Server. How come? So you could do your data access. That takes overhead. And the overhead that takes is a little more than three integer instructions, but not tremendous amount of overhead, but some overhead. However, calling inside of a function, they give you a choice of saying, I do not do data access. And if you don't, they don't even bother to set that up. Right? You'll see the context, but it won't be usable. Okay, great, fine. Everybody okay with this? Now, Transact SQL has a good library of data-centric built-in functions. The obvious choice in this, with 2 minutes to go, is the encryption functions. Nobody has ever tried to make .NET encryption functions that run in SQL Server since SQL Server introduced its own encryption functions, right? However, nobody has ever tried to write a regular expression parser in Transact SQL either, right? So use the built-ins for what they're good for. The surprising one here is string handling functions. I thought, well, gee, the SQL string handling functions, the ones in Transact SQL must be written in C. They must be faster than the .NET functions. It turns out that they may be about as fast if you call them once. But have you ever seen people that do string handling in Transact SQL? They're calling, oh, substring, and then followed by this, and followed by, they're doing five or six at a time. If you do five or six at a time of string handling functions, in fact, more than one, they're always faster in .NET. So there. Okay. I want to finish off because I only have 1 minute left to go. Goodness, I just went backwards. Of course, Transact SQL can syntax check. And by the way, data access in .NET code is like doing dynamic SQL. How come? Well, think about it. What do you pass into your data access code? A string. Sure. So, exactly. All right. So what I want to do, and again, I already said this, SQL invokes data access 2 to 3 times faster than SQL CLR. So therefore, if I have a piece of stored procedure code that just does insert, then that's always better written in SQL. But there's an overlap here. And that's what I want to show you is the overlap. Is the very last thing with 30 seconds to go. So I'm going to go over again. You guys can leave for beer if you want to without me. But I just had to show you this. So once upon a time, I asked the .NET folks if they had a poster child for SQL CLR. And they said, what do you mean? And I said, something that actually is much, much, much better in SQL CLR, but actually does data access. And they said, yes, we happen to have one. And I said, cool, could you give it to me? And they said, oh, I don't know. And then they came back and said, yeah, I guess we'll give it to you. And I said, can I give it away? And they said, I don't know, we'll have to go check. And they said, yes, you can give it away. So this is their poster child thing for SQL CLR. We're going to create a database called CLR PerfDB and use it. And we're going to create two tables, a products table and a sales forecast table. There's one, there's two. I'm trying to skip things to be quicker. Why don't you just run the whole thing? Because I actually have this as automatic deployment. Okay, so we won't create assembly in here. And let's populate products and populate the other one. Goodness, sales forecasts. Now, it turns out, anybody ever work on an MRP system in here? In an MRP system, a manufacturing resource planning system, one of the major things in an MRP system is to do something that's called, goodness, I just lost it entirely. It's a thing that you do at the end of the quarter or at the end of the month to figure out how many products to manufacture for the next month. Goodness, I'm still lost it. Okay, sorry, production scheduling. Okay, production scheduling. And basically the production scheduling job takes all the product sales and all of the sales forecast and tries to figure out how many products you want to make. Time's up. How come? Well, imagine that you make a lot of bread and you don't make enough bread. That means you didn't sell enough bread. What happens if you make a lot of bread and you don't make you make too much bread? It rots on the shelf. So this turns out to have a formula that's so outrageous that people write their PhDs to make this formula run faster. This is a version of it called the Witten-Wagner algorithm. Now, here's the Witten-Wagner algorithm written in SQL. Somebody actually went through and transposed this to Transact SQL. God, it's awful. But it actually does. I mean, it's not awful. It's just a terrible... there we go. Great. So what that means is it's just a terrible formula, right? So let's take that formula again and write it into CLR. So we just happen to have this because they just happen to give it to me. No, I did not write my own Witten-Wagner algorithm. Right, but I did check this out. So what I did was, my wife was a DBA for 30 years, and she has just retired a couple years ago, and she used to work on an MRP system. So I said to her, have you ever heard of the Witten-Wagner algorithm? And she goes, I'm a DBA, not a mathematician. Go away. And I said, oh, let's approach this a different way, right? My wife will never, you know, be nice about this. So here's it written in CLR, by the way. This is a console app. So we're actually going to compile this up as a console app. And notice what the key is here, multidimensional arrays. Remember, I said I can use arrays if I use them inside of my SQL code. And this guy is using multidimensional arrays. It does do data access. There we go. And this is just a hideous formula in CLR as it is in SQL. There we go. And it's actually going to send results out the pipe. Cool. Okay, and here's the formula. It still goes on, right? Great. So they wrote this as a console app. Let's build the solution. There we go. And they also wrote this as a piece of SQL CLR code. Trying to prove what? Well, trying to prove that, there we go. Trying to prove the idea that whether this was better to write as middle tier code or as SQL CLR code. Because somebody goes, well, this is a stupid thing to do. You should always write this in the middle tier. Depends on how close. Lovely. That's right. Depends on how close your middle tier is. Right, so what I did to see if this was an okay thing is I went and asked my wife, all right, if you've never heard of the Wagner-Witten algorithm, have you ever heard of production scheduling? And she goes, ah, production scheduling, that dog, that's an awful job. And I said, oh, so you've heard about production scheduling? And she says, yes, I have. And I said, how have you heard about production scheduling? And she goes, well, I have to run it at the end of every quarter. And basically the thing runs for 6 hours. And in fact, I got a new Solaris server so that I use once a quarter that I run this thing on. And I said, really? And she said, yeah. And I said, why does it take 6 hours? How long does it, you know, what does it do? And she goes, it takes all the data and it schleps it across the network for 2 hours, and then it munches on it for 3 hours, and then it pushes it back over the network for 1 hour. And I said, really? And I said, I know you hate that Java stuff that runs in Oracle, right? She was an Oracle DBA. I said, but if I could write a Java stored procedure that would do this in 6 seconds, would you do it? Would you use it? Now, it turns out that Oracle actually uses Java much more than SQL Server uses .NET. But be that as it may, she goes, oh, I'd want it in a second. I said, why do you know it takes 6 hours? She goes, I'm on call. Right, so I don't want to be on call for 6 hours. All right, so we'll push this in a SQL Server. Right, you've already seen this code in .NET. I'm coming to the end, really. Promise. Where's build? There we go, deploy. All right, so now that we've filled this up, what we want to actually do is try and run this. And I'm going to cheat, and I'm going to run the console one once. Now, it turns out the console one, unfortunately, is going to win in this case. And the reason why the console one wins is because, the reason why the console one wins is because it's not over the network. It's on the same machine. And so, therefore, it's going to win because all it has to do is pass the stuff back and forth in shared memory. So using my XP command shell, I'm going to execute production scheduling client, and it doesn't see where production scheduling client is. I believe I just called it production scheduling.exe. Lovely. There you go. Okay, so let's count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There we go. It's already done. 4. And in fact, notice that the .NET code will actually put out nice data. The command shell code won't. So now we've got all the buffers in memory, right? We just can't leave it at that. Oh, this is my new real fast machine. Let's see how long this takes. 4. Okay, so 4 again. 4 more seconds. All right, so let's run the .NET code after this. This is the in-process code. Now, the in-process code, again, is going to lose, but not by much. Okay. So notice why it loses is because it's going to put out all this stuff. One of these days, I'll turn off the code that puts out that stuff and see if it can at least beat it. 7. Okay. 7 seconds. And again, this is most of the 7 seconds, really it is, trust me. Huh. Well, then take it out. All right, 6 seconds. Now, let's run the SQL code. Now, when we run the SQL code, it turns out that that was the production scheduling for exactly one product. So what we have to do is we actually have to run this in a cursor, which is interesting because it will show me when the first product is done. And by the way, don't wait for the first product to be done anytime soon. It turns out that to go through all 100 products and do them in transact SQL code runs for about 6 hours. And I actually thought that it would never run. And I, at one point, just gave up on it and went to lunch and came back and did some other things. And it was done. And it was like, oh, cool, how long did it take? Oh, 5 hours and 57 minutes. So that's why I said to my wife, if you could run this in 6 seconds, would you? And in fact, this is really cool if you can afford it, if you're a Microsoft executive, because you can just start this off at the beginning of your talk, and then it won't be done by the end of your talk. Great, and then you can run it, CLR, run rings around it. Okay. So what I'm saying here is, if you're running SQL code, there's a place where there's a cutoff point here, right? If you run SQL code that has just transact SQL code, transact SQL always wins. If you run code that does always computations, then CLR code always wins. Well, this one did some computations and some transact SQL code. So where's your limit? And I had a guy do this that actually had a product with 200 stored procedures. Take the stored procedure, figure out which one does the most non-data access code, and convert that to CLR. If SQL wins, you're finished, right? Don't bother. If SQL loses in that case, just go to the next one, and the next one, and the next one after that. And when SQL starts to win, you're done, right? Fine. That would be where you'd find the line about when you use CLR with computation and data access. Any questions about that? And isn't it client-side code or middle-tier type code? It depends on how much data you have to pass across the network. Right. Imagine something that compares fingerprints. Right. There's a million ridges on each fingerprint. If you're going to pass those across the network to compare fingerprints, why not just use them in the database? Now, is this more for the DBA to keep track of? Yes, it is. Is it another thing that sucks up memory? Yes, it is. Is it another thing that sucks up cycles because database cycles are the most expensive at all? Yes, it is. I'm not arguing with any of those points. What I'm saying is you might have one or two things. Well, this will save you 5 or 6 hours, and it might be worth it. So, I think I have a summary slide here, but why bother? Right, we looked at two things today. We looked at internals of SQL CLR, and we looked at where you were going to use SQL CLR. And you'll have these available to you. And I also have the code examples on the SQL Skills website. So there's some references for them. Prefer SQL for set-based, transact SQL for wrapping data access, and CLR for user-defined functions that SQL doesn't have, compute-intensive indentation stored procedures, and access to resources outside of SQL Server. Are there any questions other than where's the beer? No questions at all? Okay, then I adjourn this meeting. Thank you for coming. Appreciate it.